Blog Talk Radio.
Nearly one-third of all American adults have high blood pressure, and more than half of them don't have it under control. Simply seeing a doctor and taking medications isn't enough for many people who have high blood pressure. A team-based approach by patients, healthcare systems, and healthcare providers is one of the best ways to treat uncontrolled high blood pressure. Patients can improve control by measuring and recording their own blood pressure between office visits and by taking medications as prescribed. Healthcare systems can use electronic health records and patient registries to find and follow up with patients and automatically notify doctors about patients who have high blood pressure readings. Healthcare providers can see patients with high blood pressure more often until control is achieved. To learn more about the ways we can all work together to achieve blood pressure control, visit www.cdc.gov/vital signs.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter at Joy Keys. Also, check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. Check it out. You can email me even. Email me, saturdaywithjoykeys@hotmail.com. And if you've missed the show, all the shows are archived. You can listen to them here at Blog Talk Radio, or you can listen on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Google, iTunes. We're all over the place. So enjoy and share with friends and family. And for those of you who have been supporting me since the beginning, thank you so much, and I really appreciate it. And I hope that you've been able to enjoy and share with friends and family. This morning, wow, I got so much to talk to this guy about. I mean, the 30 minutes really isn't going to be enough. I'm probably going to have him back on. He's a wonderful writer. He's appeared in The New Yorker, Oprah Magazine. This is his second book, but his first novel, and it's called New York, My Village. I think this is him on the line. Let's see here. Good morning. Is this Uwem?
Yes, this is Uwem, my friend.
How are you?
I'm so happy to be talking to you finally.
Are you serious? I'm happy to talk to you too. Oh, my God. Wow. That's great. You sound really awake. Now, where are you? Are you in America now? Are you overseas? Where are you?
I'm Gainesville, Florida.
Okay, so you're here in America.
Yes.
But let's talk about where are you from? Because you are a minority of minorities, so to speak. So where are you from? Tell the audience.
Yes, I am an Anang man in southern Nigeria. My state is called today the state of Akwa Ibom in southern Nigeria. My people used to be, were in Biafra, basically mm-hmm. against their will. So there are three big ethnic groups in Nigeria, the Igbos, the Yorubas, the Hausas. Then you have like a 247 minority groups, or you have 499 minority groups. Nobody really knows the exact number.
It's so funny because in the book, you have a funny story about that. And one of the stories is the character has to prove that he's part of his tribe. Like, does it really exist? That is so crazy. I can't imagine going up to some window and somebody asking me, are you really black? But let me tell you, Uwem, here in America, we have what they call colorism.
Yes.
And people are treated different, you know, based on their color. And I'm sure it happens in Africa, South America, India, China, all over. But, you know,
yeah.
Here, when you're light-skinned, people assume you must be mixed. So they're like, what are you? Like, one of your parents is white? Are you Indian?
Yes.
What you can't be all black. And I'm like, no, both my parents are black. They're both black, and my grandparents are both black. And, like, you know, you have to, like, try to make them believe that you're really black, even though you know you are, but they try to make you believe, you know, like, I remember one time somebody told me, somebody said you were from England. Who told you that? What? Oh, gosh. So I feel your pain. I feel some of your pain. So now, why are you writing a novel instead of short stories? Because your first book, Say You're One of Them, made the best of the year list at People Magazine, Wall Street Journal, and many other places. New York Times made that first book a New York Times editor's choice. Why now a whole novel instead of short stories?
I had so many things I wanted to talk about. I did not think I could accomplish this with a short story or a collection of short stories. So I decided to go for a novel. If you remember correctly, my stories were always long. And even in that collection, I had two novellas that were at 120 pages, you know, each. So this was the time for me to, you know, to go for a novel, to see how much of what I had in my to-do list, as it were, I could bring, you know, into the flow of the novel. So, for example, I wanted to talk about the Biafran War. I wanted to talk about, you know, what it means to be a minority of minorities. I wanted to talk about immigration. I wanted to talk about, the immigrant story. I wanted to talk about racism in America, in publishing, in the church, in the neighborhood. So
you had a lot to talk about.
Yes,
you had a lot to talk about, and you know what? It came out beautifully in the book, and I wondered because in the book your main character is a writer, and you know he's going to work for a publishing place, and he has to read other novels. I wondered what kind of notes did you get from your editor from the publishing company for this book? What kind of notes did you get?
What kind of notes? How do you mean? I don't understand,
like,
the question.
Well, like when you sent in the manuscript and they called you and said, we're interested, but we need this to change or we want you to add this. What were those things?
Oh, okay. Oh, Joy. It's a whole long story of... It was very difficult because it was rejected many, many times.
Really? Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
It was rejected many, many times. But the editor who accepted it within 24 hours. So that, you know, that's a miracle to have the, you know, she read the first 70 pages. Ellen Mason of Norton read the first 70 pages, you know, said to me, when we want this novel, can we get this novel from you? I was so shocked because I expected it to take 2 months before she would, you know, make a comment. So going back to your question, that was the note I got. We want this novel. This is so wonderful. We like the voice. We like the themes. This is so out of the left field, but it works.
Yes, that's great. You know, she knew right away. You know, it's like when you taste food, you know right away.
Yeah.
Once you taste it, it's like, I don't like, I'm never going to eat that thing again, or I'm never going to eat that thing again, or I wish I could have it every day of my life, you know? So she knew right away that she wanted your book. Now, let me skip back a little bit, because I should really be saying Father Uwem Akpan, correct? Because you are an ordained Jesuit priest, correct?
No, I left the priesthood. I left the priesthood six years ago.
You left, but you were in the past, yes.
Yes, I was.
So my question is, what made you leave? What was the moment? What was the catalyst that made you leave the order?
To write. I was struggling a lot. It was more than having many lives in one. And I knew if I could let go of one, you know, the priesthood or writing, I would be able to, you know, to write. And I thought what needed to go was the priesthood. So I got out of it.
So now, how do you know you were a good writer? How did you know that it was going to be successful? What gave you the belief, the strength to say, okay, I'm good at this?
You know, it's basically faith, one. Two, by this time I had written my first book. So I had something to cling on. But I did not know at this point that a novel would come together. So it was basically, you know, a leap of faith. A jump, you know, a leap into the dark, as it were. And this novel has taken me 13 years to write. If I'm looking at actual writing time, when this particular story or book began, it began as a short story. So you were asking me about short stories, you know, just a moment ago. This book began as a short story in 2014. And I just kept expanding and expanding and braiding things together until I got, you know, a substantial number of my issues dramatized, staged. You know, so it was a long, painful process.
Yes, but you know, it was worth it. And one of the things, you have so many issues that you do talk about in the book, but one of the things you talk about is the character has to work in the white space. And when he goes to his first day at the publishing and he realizes he's the only one. Now, you are also a writer. Have you been in white spaces where you were the only one? And what did that feel like for you? Was it the same as the character?
The strangeness, at least of that first day, was the same. Yes, I've been in many white spaces. I'd been to some, you know, churches in this country to minister as a priest, and I was the only black person. The rest of the congregation was white, just plain white. You know, but by the end of the day, they accepted me very well. But just walking in there and seeing how white it was, so I knew. But by the time, you know, mass began, and they saw that I knew what I was doing, and then I became their beloved priest, and you know, all of that. I've been in many classes in this country where I was the only black person. But talking directly about publishing, after my first book, I started visiting the big publishing houses of America. And whenever I walked in, you know, I was always shocked how white it was. The more shocking thing was running into minorities, their fellow black people, sometimes,
mm-hmm.
and they looked at you equally shocked that you were there. In fact, sometimes it was as if they wanted to flee from you, as if you were not permitted to exist together in this world.
Uwem, it's very difficult because of the competition. You know, people are thinking, you know, I'm here, so I got this spot, you know, for the black person. Here comes this African. Like, who does he think he is? I got the spot already. You can't be here.
Yeah.
You know, because if you're here, then it's going to take something from me by you being here. You know, it's going to take maybe some jobs or things away from me. And that is a perception. It may not be the reality, but that is the perception.
Yeah.
And your discussion about you being the priest in the all-white churches, you know, as the priest, if you think about it, you're in a position of power. You're in a position of somebody. They already know you have a certain amount of knowledge. But if a random black person, such as your character even, in the one scene where he's not dressed in African garb and they think he's African-American, the perception of those white people will be different, you know? So as a priest, even though you're African, you have power. You had power there, you know?
Yes, I know. But I'm still telling you it was weird because you look at the faces of some of the people at first and the shock that you would be ministering to them. So you could see also that it took them a bit of time. You know, and then you go to minister to people, white people who are dying, and their relatives tell you as you're in the hallway, please don't be offended. Our dying father or mother is not very used to black people, you know, but they're about to die. They're about to die. And they need the anointment. So I've been in all kinds of strange situations. So it wasn't difficult for me to, you know, to deal with this, come up with, you know, a church scene that was complicated, that was full of racism and tense and all of that.
I loved your character, Keith, the black American character in your book. And he was kind of like the representative of like all the black people, I think, in America to some degree. But and your relationship, the character's relationship with him. Did you have a Keith in real life with you? Were there Keiths that you bumped into that you had friction with and then maybe became friends? Or it was back and forth. Do you have Keiths now in your life?
I am friends with some African-American folks. I think I've had someone who was not a friend before and now is a friend. The times it didn't work out, I got away from that very quickly. Yeah, but when I came to this country the first time, 1993, I was a student at Creighton University, and there was this amiable, lovely black guy. We always met at the same time on campus. I think he would be finishing. He was finishing his class at that time. I was going towards my class at that time. He would always say to me, "What's up?" And I'll say to him, "What's up?" That's how we greeted each other in the, you know, in the mid-morning. So one day, after like a month, I felt I should step forward and shake hands with him. Almost telling me about my African accent. Yeah, he wouldn't shake hands with me. It bothered me. I never greeted him anymore.
Yeah,
I don't know why.
That was very hurtful.
Yeah, so I don't know why I would be saying what's up to someone for a month or two, and I can't or couldn't shake hands with him. But you know, so I knew immediately that there was something, you know, wrong. But I was also part of the African, the Black Students Association on campus. And
okay.
So many of them received me very warmly. You know, so I've been in a situation that has allowed me to experience things, to notice things, to observe things, and to have that feeling that allows me to create characters that will do my bidding. So
Go ahead. I was going to say I love the women in the book. You don't have many, but the best one is the little girl Ujjayi. I love
yes.
her. I thought that was great. She was very confident. She was very assertive. She was knowledgeable.
Yes.
And, you know, women and young girls sometimes don't see themselves in a book. It's always the boy character
yes.
who's smart, who's assertive, who knows everything. And the women
yes.
character is a little behind. So Ujjayi was an awesome character. Just her young, youthful voice was great. Who in your life, what women in your life impacted you? Who was the greatest impact as in terms of women in your life?
It would have to be my mom.
Mm-hmm.
It would have to be my mom. Yeah, actually my editor, Ellen Mason, who has really, really helped me write this book. That was one of the characters that quickly caught her attention, you know,
okay.
the relationship come, and this girl is superb. It brings a lot to the work because it's so innocent, and just seeing how the people born here in, you know, in the diaspora, Africans born here in the diaspora, how much they long for home,
mm-hmm.
how much what their parents have been telling them has shaped that longing for a home they have never visited. And how much she loves Ekong. I've always tried to, each time I write about children, you know, work hard to, you know, for lack of a better term, work hard to make their characters, you know, work. So,
mm-hmm.
this book, it was very clear also in my mind that I wanted to create this girl character that was, you know, like, you know, Ujjayi. Ujjayi means
yeah, yeah.
beauty in my language. It means beauty.
Okay.
So, yeah, when I created her first, I gave her another name, which was Itido, which means good, you know, good character. There are also people being named that way. But finally, I decided to go with, you know, with Ujjayi. So,
okay.
I have my niece.
She's like Ujjayi.
Yeah, she's like Ujjayi. She would not let me have peace. She's always, let's play. Uncle, I never see you. You're always in America. You're in now.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, for the first time, I stayed in their house for 2 weeks. And that was the first time she was seeing me for 2 weeks. And I work at night. I sleep during the day. So whenever she woke up, by the way, her name is Utibe. So Utibe, I'm giving you a shout out here. So whenever she woke up, she would come to my, you know, come to my room. It's like 7 in the morning. She's like, Uncle, wake up, wake up. Why are you still sleeping? Wake up, wake up. And then she'll say, I hope you'll be awake when I come back from school. And she'd come back from school. She'll barrage into, you know, into my room. And Uncle, wake up, wake up. If you don't wake up, she'll jump on the bed and stamp and jump till the bed starts heaving and you get up because she wants to play with you. So I have, you know, whenever I have time, I always
try to spend with her.
Yeah, spend time with, you know, other children. Get to ask them, how is school? You know, what are you doing today? So
that's
important for children.
That's important. It's important for children to have, you know, supportive family and people that love them with no strings attached. Now, one of the things you do talk about in the book is the Biafran War, which is very, very violent and uncomfortable scenes to read. And different characters have different traumas. Your character, and if, correct me if I'm wrong, he was a drinker. Is his drinking part of his trauma? Is that how he's dealing with his trauma? Because he tries to stop, but then he started again. And why? Because he was having some difficulty here in America. Do you see, what habits do you see people having to deal with their trauma besides drinking? People smoking, people having too much sex. What do you see in your community on how people deal with trauma from that war?
Yeah. First of all, I like how you have, you know, brought this up. Because I did not close that circuit. I did not, you know, say he's drinking because of his war trauma. But it's exactly the kind of thing I could have said, and it will make sense also. You know, having said that, the fact remains that he's an alcoholic. He's got drinking problems. And he comes to America. And the trauma he's facing here, the stress is facing here, has sent him back, you know, to, you know, to drinking. What I have noticed is, you know, when people are trying to cope, they develop, you know, bad habits. You know, people drink, people get into drugs. Now, when what they're dealing with is gone, they're stuck with the bad habits. So that's generally how I see people dealing with you know, trauma, you know, with stress, you know, difficult situation. The Biafran War was very painful to the minorities, to the Igbos, to even the families of the soldiers who came, of the Nigerian soldiers. Some of them lost their breadwinners, they lost their fathers, they lost their husbands. So like any war, it was very painful. What was not done well in Nigeria, which is what my book is doing, is to look at this war from the perspective of the minorities of the Niger Delta. For example, the Anans, my people, and to see what Biafra did to them. Because up till now, the big stories of Biafra have been written by the Igbos, people who wanted Biafra and continue to want Biafra today. And I'm just saying, look, have you asked the minorities whether they want Biafra? No, they have not. In some cases, they're very disrespectful. It's like we don't, we will just do it. If you like it, you like it. If you don't like it, you like it. You don't like it, which is very ironic because this is how Nigeria is treating them. It doesn't mean that every Igbo person wants Biafra. Just as, you know, it doesn't or did not mean that every white person wanted, you know, Africa colonized. Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
When your leaders make these decisions, they make these decisions on your behalf. if privilege is coming, you enjoy this. If there are consequences, you know, most times people always, you know, also enjoy this. But what I've also done in the book is to offer my reader a sort of a comparative, you know, history of violence in America and violence in Nigeria. So when
and Argentina, when we read you also talk about Argentina.
Yes.
You talk about
you know,
the Rome situation. And I love it. There's a lot of different to show that all over the world and many different people are dealing with trauma, maybe from war, maybe from, you know, adjacent situations, if you will. Even here, you talk about one of the characters talks about the lynching stories that her family didn't believe. And then she went back and had to apologize once she became enlightened in college. So that was another person dealing with trauma. So everybody has a story. You don't know where they're coming from. Be kind to everyone. I think that's how I kind of feel like what I read in the story, you know. Why don't you read can you read some from the book, because we talk about that. Can you read a little bit from the book?
Yes. Can I read from the embassy?
Yeah, that's great.
Can I read?
Yes, great scene.
So this is chapter 2. Ekong is going to attempt to get his visa a second time. It was rejected the first time. It had been raining all week, and the most recent national power cut and internet dysfunction were 3 days old when I hit Lagos for my repeat visa interview. I was as prepared as I could be. Andrew and Thompson had written to the embassy. Molly, my supervisor in America, said they had attestations by experts from Yale and Columbia universities that the Anangs existed. I did not mind this humiliation as long as I got the visa. When I arrived at the embassy that drizzly, windy July morning, I took off my shoes and socks and rolled up my trousers to my calves, for the street was flooded. Others had done the same. I put up my umbrella. I held my footwear and my folder almost above my head and stepped out into the rain. Despite the weather, the market near Carrington Crescent was booming. Even the street photographers had set up huge lit transparent balloons on podiums above the floor to do business. They looked quite upbeat, as though they had figured out how to generate electricity directly from the deluge. I was glad the embassy let us into the first part of the building. I found space to put back on my socks and shoes. Though some warmth had returned to my feet, the place smelled of wet shoes and clothes and damp perfume. Mercifully, someone had turned down the air conditioner. In this, I recognized a few people from the last time. But the most striking was the old Bequara man. His neck revealed he had layered on two sweaters to beat the cold, but it was still easy to see he had lost weight. Sniffling and sneezing and without his gold tooth, he looked quite different. His smile was gone too. Now, when he was not running his tongue over his new tooth, he was touching his mouth gingerly in a way that suggested he was still recovering from the dentist's visit. When he coughed, it sounded like a truck's busted exhaust pipe, causing everybody around him to grumble and jostle. As soon as he saw me, he instinctively moved away. I think that, you know, that will do.
Yeah, that's great. You know, that the scene before, oh my God, it's hilarious with the lady and her clothes situation. I'm not going to say what it is. It's a hilarious scene. You know, but and there's so many, and okay, and all I'm going to say is, if you don't like bed bugs, if you don't like bed bugs, which nobody does, but if you really don't like bed bugs, just maybe read a chapter a day, because you don't want to overwhelm yourself, because there's a whole theme of bed bugs going on in this story here. That is amazing. Yes. That it messes everything up. That they just come, yes, and mess everything up, you know? Uwem, thank you so much for writing this book. I think it will educate people about the minorities and their story. I love how you describe your village, the lake and the colors, the fog. It's just very wonderful. I want to come visit. I want to have some of the mangoes and be drunk like the insects that you were talking about.
Oh, man.
So,
oh, man.
Yes.
That's
yes,
my
very,
fictional.
Very wonderful.
Yeah. That's my fictional village. When you come to my real village, it has no river. It has no, the church is not like that at all. It has no valley. But you'll still be able to eat the mangoes and enjoy the people.
Okay. That's okay. That's fine. I love mangoes. As a matter of fact, I have dried mangoes right now on the top of my refrigerator. I love mangoes. So,
oh, man,
yes.
I love mangoes too. Are you in Philadelphia?
Oh, yes, I am in Philadelphia. Let me ask you, and this will be my last question. What is your favorite Anang dish, food that you love to eat?
Pankukwa. Aferefan.
And what is that?
Money. Pardon?
What is that made of?
Pankukwa is made of cocoyam and leaves and fish or meat and spices. Aferefang is also leaves. It's vegetables. It's just wonderful, wonderful. I eat a lot of my local food. I've learned how to, you know, cook them. This morning, you know, at around 4 a.m., I made some akara, so I can eat later on today. Akara is made out of beans. So I love to eat a lot here in the U.S. and back in Nigeria. If I go to Europe, I do a lot of eating.
Well, you know, I'm going to have to come to Florida. I'm going to have to come to Florida to taste some of the Anang, or you're going to have to FedEx me a frozen package so that I can try. I love trying all different kinds of foods from all over.
Yeah, if you come, we get to eat together. Uh-huh.
Okay.
I know that there is, there is Philly steak burger. Is there such a food?
Uh-huh. Yeah, Philly cheesesteak. Yeah, you like
those?
Yes. Okay. Well, you know they send those. You know they can send them to you in the mail, you know. They have certain places. I think they ship them. But it's not like having a fresh one. You got to have a fresh steak sandwich. It's the best.
Yes.
Okay, well, when you come to Philadelphia, then maybe, you know, I'll have to take you, because they have chicken cheesesteak and they have regular like beef steak. So that you can try either one of those.
I will call you when I come to Philadelphia.
Okay, you call me. Thank you so much, Uwem. We've run out of time now, but I had a wonderful conversation with you, and I wish you
Thank
so much success with this book. And
thank you.
What's the next book? What's the next book? You have something writing now?
No, I'm still trying to get it together. So I don't know what it will be yet. Maybe it will be set in Philadelphia.
Yes, and cheesesteaks. But no bed bugs. Please, no bed bugs. Oh, man. Thank you so much, Uwem. You have a wonderful weekend, okay?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Joy. Thank you.
You're welcome. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Thank you, everybody. I just got off the phone with Uwem Afan. We were talking about his new book, New York, My Village. I'm going to be giving away some copies of his book, so I encourage you to follow me on Twitter, at Joy Keys. Also, check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram. Again, I'm going to be giving away some copies, so keep your eyes peeled. You guys know you got to ask a question, answer a question, be the first one to get the answer, and you could win a copy of this book. Trust me, you will love this book. There's so many characters and stories and situations. There's comedy. You're just going to be laughing, holding your belly. And there's also serious stuff. So you're going to learn, you know, some history that you may not have been aware of about different parts of the world, not just Africa. So I really encourage you to read and learn and enjoy and share with your friends and family. Earlier, I played my Instagram chat I had with actress Regina Taylor. You can also listen to the audio of that now on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. And if you've missed the beginning of this interview, it will be archived. You can also listen to it on all those platforms, as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. You guys have a great weekend, and I'll see you next weekend. And please, don't eat too many leftovers. You might be drunk from sweet potato pie or turkey, the tryptophan in the turkey or something. Just be careful. Okay, talk to you soon.
Wonder if you should get tested for colorectal cancer? Well, it's the second leading cancer killer in the U.S., so if you're 50 or older, it's time. Screening helps find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed. Remove the polyp, prevent the cancer. Did you know there's more than one screening test? Talk to your doctor to find the one that's right for you. No more excuses, because colorectal cancer screening really does save lives. A message from HHS and CDC's Screen for Life campaign.